Board is now in session, please be seated.
Morning, Council.
Morning, Your Honor.
Ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please.
May it please the court. Good morning, Justices. This is an appeal from the denial of a motion for judgment as a matter of law or in the alternative for a new trial after a jury trial. The controversy arose out of a gas pilot program that was introduced as a result of a settlement of a PSC complaint proceeding brought by would-be gas marketers, including Burns and McBride. As a result of this settlement, customers in Delmarva's territory were given the opportunity to buy gas from marketers such as Burns and McBride instead of Delmarva. Marketers arranged for gas to be delivered at Delmarva's gate, which is the interface between the interstate pipeline and Delmarva's distribution system. Delmarva continued, obviously, to physically deliver the gas to customers over its distribution mains and billed the customers for both its delivery service, which remained regulated by the commission, and the gas that was now competitively sold by suppliers such as Burns and McBride. Initially, Delmarva was to remit the money burned by the suppliers but billed by Delmarva to the suppliers. Delmarva, in the case of Burns and McBride, read the customer's meters and transmitted data immediately to Burns and McBride electronically before validating it. Burns and McBride then would manipulate that data and according to its own procedures and return billing information to Delmarva on amounts to be charged to the customers, Burns and McBride customers, for gas consumed by them. In what proved to be an unfortunate confluence of events, the pilot program was introduced in late 1999, just as Delmarva also introduced a new billing system. Delmarva's legacy system was not Y2K compliant, and Connective, as a company-wide matter, had an interest in a unified system for both Delaware and Maryland and Virginia, which was the Delmarva piece, and Atlantic City Electric, which had a different system. So Delmarva's billing was, in effect, migrated to the C3 system developed for Atlantic City Electric. That's perhaps not exactly right, but it's close enough for our purposes now. But almost immediately, it became apparent to Delmarva, its customers, its suppliers, and the Public Service Commission staff that the new system was generating inaccurate bills. There were several sources of inaccuracy, but the problem was exacerbated, too, by the fact that basic utility and the functions, basic utility functions necessary to correct errors and bills weren't working either. To minimize and fairly soon forestall customer frustration and aggravation, Delmarva initiated manual review of the bills with volunteers from all levels of the company up to and including senior management. Bills were physically looked at by human beings to ascertain, as the billing system could not, what the correct consumption was and what, therefore, what the correct dollar amount of the bill should be. So even though it took months for the problems to be rectified internally, Delmarva fairly early was able to take most of the burden of the errors off of its customers. But at the same time, Delmarva's manager of gas operations, Mr. Driggs, realized that Delmarva's problems could cause hardship or embarrassment for the gas suppliers in the pilot program who were in the boat with Delmarva, so to speak. To mitigate that situation, Delmarva offered to purchase a supplier's accounts receivable. Burns and McBride accepted the offer, which resulted in an agreement between the two parties of February 16, 2000. That agreement contemplated that there might be discrepancies between the amounts paid by Delmarva for Burns and McBride receivables and amounts actually consumed by those customers. And the agreement specified that those discrepancies would be trued up by November 1st, 2000. Before then, however, Burns and McBride asserted, and Delmarva agreed, that Delmarva was paying substantially too much money to Burns and McBride, and Burns and McBride wanted to address that issue earlier. This resulted in an agreement dated June 29, 2000, which is Plaintiff's Exhibit 10, and it's set forth at pages A83 through A85 of Delmarva's appendix. And it brings us to the first of two issues on this appeal. If I may, I would pause now and review the standard and scope of review, as I understand it, for contractual questions that arise in this court. A question of contractual interpretation is a question of law, not fact, and that means that this court reviews it de novo. This court approaches the issue afresh with no deference owed to the court below, and certainly no deference owed to the jury either, since construction of a contract presents a purely legal question. In interpreting a written contract, the court first confines itself to the four corners of the document. If it unambiguously addresses and speaks to the issue before the court, analysis is over. The court will enforce the party's intentions as they express them. If, however, the instrument is ambiguous, the court's decisions prescribe two diverging paths. When the terms are part of a negotiated document to which each party contributed language, the court will look to extrinsic evidence to see what the ambiguous terms mean. Where, however, the document is entirely the product of the drafting by one party, the doctrine of contra proferendum applies, and if there's any reasonable interpretation of the disputed language that favors the position of the party that didn't draft it, that interpretation will be adopted. The June 29, 2000 agreement here did two things, and the operative part of the agreement is on page A84 of the appendix. The agreement placed a $700,000 cap on Burns and McBride's obligation to repay excessive payments that had been made by Delmarva, and it established a schedule for repayment of up to that amount in installments. It is uncontroverted that Delmarva's overpayments in fact exceeded the $700,000 cap. The record references are in the opening brief, but there, Mr. Drake's testimony at 835, Ms. Tosto's testimony, the CPA who did the ex post facto analysis to ascertain that, is at A56 and A193.
Mr. Inskip, you've told us a few minutes ago that there were two issues.
Right.
And I gather that you're now addressing the first issue.
Yes, yes, sir.
What is it?
The issue is whether the agreement of June 29 obligates Delmarva to make any further overpayments to Burns and McBride simply because erroneous computer data transmitted automatically by Delmarva to Burns and McBride showed erroneous consumption that Burns and McBride's customers had not, in fact, consumed. These errors were caught by Delmarva. The customers were not billed for this phantom or fictitious erroneous consumption. But Burns and McBride asserts that by virtue of the agreement of June 29, Delmarva was obligated to to pay money in the amount of those erroneous consumption figures. And even though Delmarva's overpayments to Burns and McBride had already exceeded the $700,000 cap, Burns and McBride says it has another $288,000 of money coming from Delmarva because somehow the June 29 agreement prescribes that. Delmarva's position, and in fact, when Burns and McBride when Delmarva said that it had caught the errors or caught some of them and was not remitting that money, Burns and McBride.
Well, but I'm looking now at the opinion of the court below, and unfortunately, it does not
have
a page on it, but. Regarding jury question one, it's at that part of the opinion. Judge Scott holds that agreement two was clear in its face. That's your June 2000 agreement.
Right.
It's clear in its face that it was intended to settle and cap the accounting between the parties for gas delivered through June 30th, 2000. Thus, there was no need for the jury to consider interpretation of agreement two. Seems to agree with you in that respect. He then goes on and says, jury question one merely asked the jury whether Connective had breached agreement two. This is a question of fact that is the sole province of the jury.
Where I think where the rabbit goes into the hat, Your Honor, is Judge Scott's assertion that the agreement was clear on its face. That was certainly not the interpretation that he put on it. Was certainly never clear and is not clear as I stand here today to Delmarva. That agreement only governs repayments by Burns and McBride of money that in fact had been paid by Delmarva. It does not, Delmarva asserts, unambiguously obligate Delmarva to make even further excessive payments. And The agreement is not clear on its face, and I invite the court's de novo review of that agreement to conclude, indeed, that it governs only repayment of money paid and does not say, as it could have said, that the electronic data, erroneous or not, shall control. But Mr. McBride could have easily put that into the agreement he drafted had that been his intention, but he did not. And it is certainly not Mr. Driggs' understanding that Delmarva was precluded from correcting errors. Indeed, if the court ventured into the extrinsic evidence, Mr. Driggs made clear while the agreement was being negotiated that Delmarva now had the capacity to correct errors and would do so.
If this court were to agree with the trial court's conclusion as to the meaning of the contract language, would the jury's verdict stand?
Yes. Yes. But Delmarva certainly never stipulated to what the trial court said is the clear meaning of the language. I also ought to say, although I've used up a lot of time, that there's no basis for saying, as the court below did, that Delmarva was double counting and somehow withholding money from Burns and McBride that it's also seeking in its counterclaim to recover in installment payments. No matter what, if the court orders, as I ask, that Burns and McBride pay the delinquent $280,000 plus interest, Burns and McBride will still have some $25,000 in excess of the $700,000 cap, which by virtue of that cap, we can't get back. We're just talking about an additional, fictitious, unearned $288,000. I'm going to relinquish rebuttal because I think I have to address the other issue at least a little bit. That issue is the money due at the close of the program for undelivered gas and balancing and transition services, all of which are calculated based on total consumption by Burns and McBride customers. Delmarva put audited evidence of that in, and it occupies pages 89 to 184 of Delmarva's appendix. This data was submitted to the Public Service Commission as well as to Burns and McBride, and at the direction of the commission, similar reconciliations were prepared for the other marketers participating in the pilot program. Delmarva's audited study shows that Burns and McBride customers consumed 3,635,297 CCFs of gas. CCF means 100 cubic feet. The parties agree that Burns and McBride delivered a lesser amount of gas to Delmarva, about 3,448,000. The shortfall of about 277,000 CCFs is valued at a little more than $150,000 by applying the reference spot price specified in the tariff. At Burns and McBride's invitation, but with no support in the evidence, the jury simply assumed that Burns and McBride's customers consumed exactly the amount of gas that Burns and McBride delivered. There's no basis for that. And I submit there's also no basis for the jury to ignore the only evidence of actual consumption, which is Ms. Tosto's audited study. The only thing that Burns and McBride said in opposition to it was no methodological problem of Ms. Tosto's, and she's a CPA who was cross-examined at length. The only thing that Burns and McBride says that justifies what the jury did was saying that we estimated some readings at the outset of the program when the tariff specified actual readings. That's de minimis. I mean, Burns and McBride was getting printouts that showed whether they were estimated or actual. And if it wanted to demonstrate a serious number of inaccurate estimated readings, it had the wherewithal to do so. In fact, it demonstrated precisely the opposite by claiming that Delmarva caused mass confusion by mailing postcards to customers. The mass confusion, they say this at page 29 of their brief. The mass confusion was Delmarva had already sent people to the customers' residences. So when they erroneously got postcards requesting the customers to make an actual reading, they naturally said, "What are you doing this for? You just had somebody over at our house." The problem was not insufficient actual readings, in short. It was redundant actual meter readings. And the basis for the jury's disregard of Delmarva's study is wrong. Mr. McBride conceded in a letter at page A189 that its customers, Burns and McBride's customers, should have been billed $1.4 million for their gas consumption. But if you look at Delmarva's audited study, that's at page A91, columns 6 and 9 set forth total consumption at the bottom and the total dollars that should have been billed for that, and it's exactly Mr. McBride's number. And that correlates by whatever his billing formula was with the number the consumption number reflected in Ms. Tasto's audited study. And so there was no basis to ignore that, and it was the jury did a substantial injustice by doing so. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court.
The problems with Delmarva's gas pilot program developed long before June of 2000. In fact, it really reached a head in February and led to the February agreement where my client had been paid more than $400,000 of bills and had purchased gas to put in the pipelines, which led to the February 16th agreement. My client's financial and tax year ends on June 30th, and in anticipation of closing out that year, my client did a very simple review of where it was. It looked at the bulk gas it had purchased and got a price and a number on that, and it looked generally at what it received from Delmarva to date, and it found that it was ahead by several hundred thousand dollars. So my client approached Delmarva and said, "You've been paying us too much. We have to close out our year by June 30th. We need hard actual numbers." Delmarva initially denied that their system was not functioning after February 29th, 2000. But they took a week. And although it's not in the appellant's appendix, it's in our appendix. They came back with a meeting with two estimates of the overbills. Now, the first estimate, which is found at B-135 to B-138, is a bulk estimate. I mean, they were much more precise than my client. They took the total amount of gas used, 306,000 MCFs, or 3 million some, if you did, CCFs, at approximately $4 per MCF and came out with $1.2 million. They took up how much they had paid to my client, $1.8 million, and they backed that up with references to each payment by date of each wire transfer. And then they subtracted the two and came up with an overpayment of $624,000. That was their bulk estimate. That was one way that Delmarva looked at how we eventually get to the $700,000 number. The other way was they did a review of individual accounts, and they called that their extreme billing errors. And they gave all these documents to my client, and they gave them to my client before they negotiated and signed off on the June 29th agreement. Now, this is as of June 27th, 2000. They'd taken a week, and they went through all these accounts. And they went through the column number J, and this is found at B-139 to B-143. It's Plaintiff's Exhibit 8 from trial. They went and they found all the billing errors, extreme billing errors, for individually named customers through May 31st. They didn't stop there. They added another column, K, for June billing errors. And they identified the customers for the June billing errors. And on B-140, they identified Harrington as a $3,000 error, $3,800 in June. And on B-141, they identified Donnelly at $3,900 and Petrucci at $3,900. These are all listed for June errors. This one came up to $627,000 through June. June 27th is the day of the document. And there may have been other errors, so they negotiated up to, my client would repay up to $700,000. And they signed an agreement, a three-page letter agreement, which, although was on my client's stationery in June, basically starts from the same format they used back in February, with one key change. Now, the February agreement is on Connective stationery. That's page B-128 to B-130 in the appendix. Now, the difference between the February 16 agreement and the June 29 agreement was, the similarity was, Delmarva bought all the accounts receivable. In February, they bought it through February 29th with the ability to extend. In June, they bought it through June 30th. The difference was, in February, they reserved the right to true up and correct mistakes, and they said they would do that by November 1. Now, in June, my client was trying to close out its year, so that changed. It got modified. Now, the June 29th agreement, which was reviewed by Delmarva's counsel and we know it was reviewed by Dunmore's counsel because it produced the second June 29 agreement, which goes to the second issue, and that's the issue as to its transition and balancing. But the June 29 letter first said that in the first paragraph and on page B144, that Connective, CPD, Del Marva, was purchasing all of Burns & McBride's receivables with respect to delivery of natural gas through June 30th of 2000. It continued on the first page and it said, we have both agreed that it's practical for both of us to true up and resolve finally all outstanding adjustments due for gas delivery through June 30th, 2000, rather than wait till November 1, 2000. Then it says, to this end, you've recently provided us with your reconciliation accounting for the amounts due to Burns McBride to Connective for billing inaccuracies and adjustment for gas delivered through June 30th. And those were the two charts they had delivered to them. Then it went through and it had the repayment schedule where my client agreed to repay them $700,000, up to $700,000 on a specific schedule. And then it said the following, and this is in the middle of page B145. In further consideration of this agreement and the payment by Burns McBride of the settlement amount, $700,000, Delmarva releases and forever discharges Burns McBride, of and from any and all claims, actions, causes of actions, suits, debts, sums of money, damages, accounts, bills, promises, and demands, whatsoever in law or in equity, which Delmarva has or ever had, whether known or unknown, by reason of any cause, matter, or thing related directly or indirectly to adjustments or true-up credits which were or could have been due Delmarva as a result of the purchase of the accounts receivable of Burns McBride for gas delivered from the inception of the gas pilot program through June 30th, 2000. I don't see any ambiguity in that language, but what happened next, we go to July. And there's a 30-day delay time in the payment of accounts receivable. July 7th, my client gets this computer printout for, this is page B148, this is July 7th, we are making adjustments from June. What they just agreed they weren't going to do, they're making adjustments from June. And on the first one, instead of paying $61,000 for accounts receivable, for the dates of May 31, June 1, June 2nd, June 5, June 6th, and June 7th, they wire transfer my client $22,000. They just adjusted June. It gets worse. And the next wire transfer, for June 8th and June 9th, instead of $36,000 accounts receivable for those dates, they wire transfer my client $6,000. And they say right on this document, 68FTP original. That means file transfer protocol, their terminology. And later on, we have an exhibit that says that's what they should have transferred to us. That's what they should have paid us. Here, it gets even worse because they're deducting the amounts for individuals that are on this list that they used to negotiate up to $700,000. And now they're deducting them here, and that's where the judge says they're double-dipping. Because on this one, you have Green and Felhan, who are two of the people that are on their list on the reconciliation they gave us. And it continues. There's like five or six of those individuals identified. So they deducted all that money, and they even produced the summary that they did. For the accounts receivable prior to July 1, they were supposed to have sent us $392,000. That's the basis upon which the June 29th agreement was signed. And what they sent us was $104,000. And that's $288,000.
Can I interrupt you for a minute? The claim here on appeal is that the trial judge erred in submitting to the jury the issue of whether there was a breach of the June 29th agreement. The argument being that as a matter of law, that agreement unambiguously provides solely for payments going in one direction, that is from your client Burns and McBride to DP&L. I gather that your response is that's absolutely incorrect. The agreement provides for payments going the other way as well, namely in the form of a continuation or an extension of the purchase of accounts receivable through the end of June.
Yes, sir.
And that the purchase of those accounts receivable that is, payments going in the opposite direction from Delmarva to your client, is a precondition. It's part of the consideration for the agreement to make payments back to DP&L that would be capped at $700,000.
Yes, sir. Absolutely correct.
That's your response?
Yes.
And that being the case, with that construction of the agreement, the only issue is whether DP&L did what it promised to do. And that was a jury issue.
And it also promised not to make any adjustments as a matter of law. From the second page where I read that they agreed not to do any more true-ups or adjustments for anything prior to June 30th of 2000. And they did. And in fact, that became the second jury question, if my recollection serves me, where the court asked, at the Marvis request, whether my client breached the agreement by not making the first three payments of $70,000 each. And the jury said, no, they did not. My client did not. Because Delmarva had withheld that money from the wire transfers. So it's just a matter of whether you look at it as a question of fact, because the jury found against Delmarva as fact, or if you look at the post-trial as a question of law from the section Your Honor pointed out. On both accounts, Delmarva lost below. And we submit to Your Honors this morning that if you review it de novo, you'll come to the same conclusion. This language on the second page as to Delmarva's agreement not to make any adjustments in the accounts receivable prior to June 30th as part and parcel of the $700,000 payment is unambiguous and clear as a matter of law. They bought the accounts receivable. They agreed not to make any adjustments. We agreed to pay $700,000. The second issue, if I may, Your Honor, is the consumption issue. And the entire premise of Delmarva's argument is that the jury had to accept this in-house accounting that Delmarva did way post-fact, when in fact the most credible evidence as to the consumption of gas, the only credible evidence really as to the consumption of gas, was how much gas my client purchased. Delmarva was required by the PSC to take an actual fiscal reading. And that was required because there's gas in the line. They wanted to know the actual physical reading on the date the transfer went from a Delmarva customer to a Burns McBride customer. That was right in the task. We put it, I think, three or four different locations in our brief. That's critical because to have hard numbers on consumption, you have to know what the actual meter reading is. Delmarva failed to do that. They put in no evidence at trial as to how many customers they failed to take an actual fiscal reading for Burns McBride. We don't know to this day. My client has never received and testified at trial. It never received that information from Delmarva. It's not in evidence. It's not in the appendix anyplace. And while Mr. Inskip can say it's de minimis, there's nothing in the record to say that. Mr. Driggs testified we made our best efforts. And Ms. Tosco said her understanding was, but she had no personal knowledge. It was so prevalent that they didn't make a phone call or just call a couple of Burns McBride customers. And we had 2,732 customers. They sent out postcards. Postcards were to go to those individuals that hadn't had an actual reading. They went to all of our customers. We don't know how many did not have actual readings to this day. Second, we got inconsistent numbers throughout the entire program from Delmarva. We had virtually 2,732 customers. My client spent $400,000 on this program for the computerization and the advertising, and it got 2,732 customers. On B-159, we got Delmarva's printout of how many customers we have on a monthly basis. For December, we had 1,857. We're missing about 900 customers there. For January, 2,535. For February, 2,865. We have more customers than we ever had. For March, we had 2,517. For April, we had 2,527. For May, we had 2,513. For June, we had 2,498. For July, we had 2,637. It doesn't matter how you cut it. Even if you average it, we're still missing 10% of our customers. But they got it. They got it. We put
refers to the record, and it's in our answering brief, there are inconsistencies in what they told us. They told us in late April, and this is B-134 in the transcript, that we had over-delivered by 200,500 CCFs. Over-delivered by 200,500 CCFs, B-134. That's at the end of the heating season. We had over-delivered gas. Somehow, between then and October, when we're into the summer, we reversed that and we're under-delivered. And they seek to charge us for it. They give us inconsistent data, and it's in the record, for consumption for the same month. In April, they tell us that our December consumption was 267,090 CCF, and B-159 somehow miraculously from April of 2000 to August or July of 2000, our December 1999 consumption goes up to 356,000. It gets worse. They didn't do readings, they didn't have all actual readings at the end. So we have, in street language, garbage in, garbage out. Because if you don't have actual readings, and they could put in evidence of how many estimates they had going in and going out, but it's a compound problem. It gets compound, and I'll just use a hypothetical and round numbers. If you have 10% estimates going in, you don't know for those 10% customers exactly how much usage you actually have for that 10%. Because you never had their real hard starting number. And if you have 10% going out, you don't know for that 10% how much you actually have for actual usage because you didn't take a hard reading at the end. Now, that would, one would think, doesn't equate to 10% of the customers. It actually probably comes out statistically to 19%. Because 10% of 100%, you have an overlap of 1%, so you got 9% where you might have had hard readings at the beginning, but not at the end, and 10% from the beginning. So you really are looking at a compound problem. And Dunbarton did nothing at trial to try to back up their accountant's study to who, and the accountant, Hotsko, testified she had no personal knowledge. And the record was replete with examples of actual readings being wrong. The Dorset Apartments, I think, was $8 million for 1 month on an actual reading. And all the exhibits that are in our appendix show three or four. There was one to Sanford School that was off by several million dollars in a month. There were customers. There's even one example of now state solicitor Malcolm Coben in October of 2000 in an actual reading. And he was barely, if it hadn't been caught, he would have been billed $3,400 for that month. So when the jury listened to Delmarva say, well, our numbers now, much later, are hard, they never put in the supporting evidence to ever convince anyone in the courtroom, including the jurors and anybody, I guess, except Delmarva's counsel and Mr. Driggs, that they had accurate numbers. So the jury went to the only item in the record that everybody agreed to, and that was how much gas Burns and McBride delivered to the Delmarva system. And that included the 2.5% loss. And they based their number where they said my client owes them $16,000 and $6,000, amounts that my client had tendered to them in May of 2001, based upon that number. And in questions 3 and 4, they came back and found against my client on those numbers because the only reliable evidence that everybody agreed to, including Dunbarber, was the number of CCFs that my client had delivered to their system. And that's what they based the decision on. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.